Welcome to the Workflow Show. This is episode 202. I'm Merrill Davis, alongside with my cohort in workflow crime, Nick Gold. And today we have a very special guest.
Yes. So today joining us, and this is to continue our ongoing series of bringing Friends o' Chesapeake into our podcasting midst, is longtime friend o' Chesapeake, David Helmley of Adobe. Now, we've known Dave for a good number of years. We've been an Adobe partner for many, many years. Obviously, they're kind of front and center when it comes to creative technology. And Dave, your title is Senior Sales Manager, Pro Video Audio Products. Oh, Video Audio Products, America's Boss. I always just kind of describe you as like, yo, one of the big video dudes over at Adobe. Can you maybe like break down a little more officially for us?
Well, first, let me thank Chesapeake for having Adobe on the show today. We're very excited to come out and tell you guys what's new. As you know, we have lots of things to talk about today. But on myself, I haven't quite made it to 20 years at Adobe just yet, but I'm working towards that. So I've been here a long time. And currently, I run all of North and South America for Pro Video. So what I run is a consulting group, a lot of what you guys have here at Chesapeake, which is, you know, we're this trusted advisor team that gets out and talks to customers and say, we've kind of seen it all, we think, but we're learning new stuff every day. And we work with integrators like Chesapeake and get our heads together to try to solve problems for customers. So it's almost like a solutions consulting team.
Now, you get to get in front of a lot of pretty interesting Adobe customers, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We have lots of great customers working on, you know, obviously movies and TV shows and places like, you know, Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So you get to see a lot of that line of work, a lot of forensic and investigation work. So Pro Video takes us to a lot of, and Pro Imaging, for that matter, takes us to a lot of interesting places.
And I'll mention that David actually happens to be a fellow Maryland resident. You're based down in Annapolis, so
yeah.
Kind of a hop, skip, and a jump from us, and that puts you in touch with a lot of those Govy types, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. And one thing on that is I'll tell you that, you know, Adobe's a great company because they're family first. So they pretty much just hire people wherever they are, and we all telecommute, as you know, anyway. So it's great because in my 18-plus years at Adobe, I've always been in Annapolis, other than I'm not home as much as I'd like to be.
So fancy. I love it.
You've
love
been
it.
There for a while, not to make you feel old or anything, but
oh,
I mean...
Yeah.
This fellow looks very young, just for our listeners.
Dave is as youthful as they get, but... Adobe has changed focuses, or at least I think it's fair to say expanded dramatically in their breadth of offerings in that 19-20 year period.
Yep.
What are the standout things as an Adobe guy that you can say you've really seen shift within the company in that time that you've been involved with them?
Well, I think it's direction. I mean, you know, with the younger kids coming out that, you know, they've had video on some device for as long as they can remember it. I mean, I think looking at you two, you know, not too far from my age here, we probably still call it videotaping. Will you pick up that phone and videotape that whatever's going on? And my kids would look at it and goes, there's no tape in the phone. But it's just so you sort of see this shift from different technology, and it's ever changing. So I just have to say, from that standpoint, it's really interesting. Who would have thought we would be talking about 6K video or 4K video? You know, we were excited when we had 640, 480 video. So it's never ending. So now I'm just not surprised when we're talking about 8K video and beyond. I mean, it's just the changes to me. You're almost numb to it at this point.
Is there part of the creative media technology space that Adobe isn't touching that you think maybe they'll be getting more into? Or I mean,
we get a lot of question on 3D. You know, it's like that's an obvious place where we don't really have a true 3D app. And we've, you know, over the years that I've been here, we've given that a lot of thought. And honestly, to take something like that on and not really do it 100% or bring these companies together, it's like, you know, the companies that do that are doing an amazing job. They're working with Adobe very closely. You've seen what we've done with Maxon.
Yep.
Obviously, in After Effects is pretty amazing. We've announced some XML stuff that works in Smoke, which does a lot of other different things. So it's not like we're trying to take every single vertical and just say, let's just throw that at Adobe. I think we acquire companies and acquire technology when it makes sense. and when it can really enhance the experience for the user. And I also think we try to figure out what percentage of the user can get a benefit out of this if we, you know, bring this company on board or we go in this certain direction. So I've been really excited to see over the years that we don't just buy the companies for the sake of buying them, and we really try to make them a part of what's going on.
Now, one of the things I think is fair to say is Adobe is very much a software company. You're not trying to bundle hardware and software, from what I see. You're not releasing proprietary hardware. You're not snapping up hardware companies. You didn't buy Blackmagic or AJA or anything like that over the years, which I think some people maybe imagined you moving towards. Does that speak something about Adobe, that the software side of this industry seems to be very much the emphasis?
Yeah, I think it's the focus. When you start getting into hardware and manufacturing and sourcing, it's just, for one, it's a distraction because it keeps you from getting done what you really want to get done. And there's just people that can do that better. Companies like Avid that have to balance both hardware and software, it's not an easy task. And I think for us, you know, we're just going to try to make the best possible software that we can. And the most important thing to us to get that done is our partners. And if we were to acquire a company that made I/O boards or something like that, I think there's all these other partners that would be sort of left in the dust that have been with Adobe this whole time. And it's a true ecosystem and partnership. And we're seeing the same thing with products like Adobe Anywhere. We can talk about that later. Some of these products that will connect to servers and hardware, that's not something that we really want to get into. We're going to require other companies and asset management companies to bring a total solution together. So, and again, some of the companies you guys are already working with today. So,
Merrill, you've been working with a lot of our clients on Creative Cloud and mm-hmm. explaining to them Creative Cloud, doing your best, making sure they understand this is the future of how they engage with Adobe for their desktop creative software. What are you hearing from our clients? You know,
sure.
Their concerns, their questions, their excitement.
Well, and I think, Dave, I think you probably have encountered this, and I think anybody who's had a conversation about cloud, certainly when it was sort of in the ether and not something totally realized.
One might say, in the cloud.
In the cloud.
Cloudier.
Well, the phrase cloud itself presented early on a very confusing sort of landscape, because there was questions like, well, so do I need to be connected to the internet in order to be able to utilize my Adobe software? And of course, the answer is no. But so we've encountered that, and certainly the questions, quite not surprisingly, have nothing really to do with the feature set. I mean, if there's anything that I've seen from the customers, it's they know what they're getting and they want it. It's just the nebulous sort of question of how is this new paradigm going to operate? I know that Adobe sort of put their toe in the water first, and some other industry fellows are following in suit. But I'd say the thing that I'm asked the most about Creative Cloud is, how do I get it?
Right.
That's really the question. Is I used to just come to you, and you either once upon a time delivered me shrink wrap, but more recently TLP licensing. So how, as an organization, how do we get everything that Creative Cloud has to offer? And is that something as easy as 1, 2, 3?
Yeah, good questions. First of all, you hit it on the head when you said it doesn't run in the cloud, because we have a lot of people that assume I have to have an internet connection to make it work.
So this is not Office 365.
It's not Office 365, and you're not physically running anything off the web. It's basically an app store, much like you would have on your iPhone. That's the easiest way to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
As far as getting the software, obviously you can go to adobe.com and just go to the downloads page and you can download the trials and figure that out. And they work for 30 days, so you get to sort of play around with them.
Then you can buy it from your VAR.
Well, that's the next thing I was going to talk
systems.
About. The thing that you can do, so you can take your installers that you guys hopefully have here. So we make those available to the VARs and the integrators. So customers, as they're setting these customer machines up, they're going to have it all preloaded by the time they get it. Really no different than what they had before. Right. So trying it one way and saying, hey, that's what I want. Then they go ahead and say, on my new system, I would just like to have everything ready to go. Now, what's great about that is when they set that thing up and you get it back in your office or wherever you're working, you can just go ahead and type in your credentials and everything's just going to work, because your new serial number is actually your email address or however you've set that up. And that's
right.
The hard thing for people to figure out.
We've done away with the traditional sense of a serial number at this point.
Right.
And it's tied to an Adobe ID, and that's how they're going to manage assigning seats and all that other wonderful and exciting stuff as it relates to where it ends up on a workstation and how.
Well, and speaking of the how, it's a really good point because we tell customers all the time, you should just try it. You can, let's say they have CS6 on there. Download the CC trial. You don't have to take CS6 or CS5 off and just see, yep, this is going to fit my need, right? So at that point, it's like, okay, if that's what you want, you can continue to use that and right on up into the point to where you get, you know, your new machine, or they should really call people like Chesapeake to say, before I push the buy button, am I doing the right thing? Is this the best way for me to buy this? Because the thing that people don't understand, when you buy it off of the web, that's like a creative, what do we call a CCM, a Creative Cloud membership. If you're in an organization that has multiple people, probably not the best way to buy that. So that's really where Chesapeake comes in and says, hey, we've got things that we can sell you where you get really more control as a group over your software, which is really important because if you have what we call a team membership or an enterprise membership, I want to be able to control who gets to use it, how they use it. I don't know if I want people updating all the time. Well, that's a huge benefit. IT might want more control. Let's sort of get finished with this project before we do that. So this whole idea of team and collaboration is sort of where you guys come in. So I just like to point that out.
Certainly, and we act as that intermediary. We exactly. act as that overlay for many of our clients, and it's really important to understand why going to the next level on a Creative Cloud for Teams membership is appropriate for mostly our client base, because well, certainly you don't want a fellow who leaves the company taking his seat.
Well, exactly. And it's more to that trusted advisor yeah. role where sure. it's like, hey, here's how we work, or maybe you already know the client really well and you can advise them to say, this is probably the best way for you to get cloud. But the problem is, the reason I mentioned the trial, just getting people to try it mm-hmm. without disrupting the work they're doing today, very easy to do.
Sure.
So let me just make a point there, because it's a big one and it's some quote-unquote pushback or a big question mark I've heard from a lot of folks, which is, well, if I now enroll in Creative Cloud, and it's basically software as an annual subscription essentially, mm-hmm. is Adobe pushing me updates? Is Adobe forcing me to get updates? What if I have, you know, we all know that a lot of creative users use plugins. They rely on plugins sure. very heavily, whether it's in their editor, within their graphics package, like After Effects. And it can sometimes take a little while for those plugins to get updated for newer versions of host software. Yep. And there's often charges associated with that. People have to consider when it's an appropriate time to update the host. So then they can kind of couple decisions right. about updating the plugins. And they're worried, oh, well, Adobe's just going to push me the update, and then suddenly I'm either going to be forced into buying plugin upgrades, or my plugins just aren't going to work and the upgrades aren't even available. You know, how does that work once you're on Creative Cloud?
That's a great question, because there's a lot of plugins that people use that are just equally as important as, say, Photoshop or After Effects or Premiere. I mean, you cannot produce what you need to produce without that plugin. It's sort of your identity. So we understand that. So to that end, we make available on the cloud, if you go to, say, Photoshop webpage, and you'll see where it says Photoshop CC, you can click to download it. If you click and hold on the link, a dropdown will appear, and you'll see CS6, for example, available to download.
So I just want to make this very clear. Anybody who signs up today for Adobe Creative Cloud for Teams, even if, for example, they have CS5.5, and that's the last time they did an update, they will be entitled to, right now, Adobe CC, and they will also be CS6.
Yep. And so you're saying when the next major releases come out next year, say, hypothetically, mm-hmm. they'll be able to get 7.
Yeah, you'll still be able to get 6. You'll have 3 to choose from, for example.
And do you think that'll be like in perpetuity? Like,
I think it's our intention, because your email or your team email becomes your serial number. The idea is just get your work done. You may have a plugin that only worked in CS6, for example, and maybe the company went defunct, or it doesn't do what you need it to do. By the way, this also includes maybe stuff that we have in the product that for some reason might not have carried forward, but that's very important. So we always want to make sure you can do that. Also, let's take a TV broadcaster or maybe an independent editor. You know, my neighbor's one of them who makes TV commercials, and he makes a lot of his money when people come back and say, hey, I need you to change the annual percentage rate on this car commercial or whatever. And he has to open up an old project with old plugins and whatever else. He just wants to be able to open it up, respin it, make his change fee money, and export it, and he's done. So for a guy like that, it's extremely important because he would spend half his day trying to get a CS4 project open looking exactly like it looked. Well, then he just might as well re-edit the whole thing, which is what he ends up doing anyway. So to me, this is a very powerful thing.
So obviously when you download 7, it's not going to make your 6 disappear. What about more minor updates? If I kind of update my Creative Cloud app to the 7.1 version of Premiere, is 7.0 still going to exist as a separately executable program?
No, what you would see is just, you know, and again, today you would just see CC, for example. I think the numbers will have to come into play as we, you know, we're only a few months into this, but the methodology is correct. So I think for major upgrades, you'll see
separate apps
numbers
in your applications folder.
Under the CC family, absolutely. Yeah,
so the other thing that I try to remind people, but you know, I'd like you to maybe say a few words about, is that Creative Cloud is more than access to both, as you're saying, older versions of the apps and always the latest and greatest. Of course, if you have an active cloud membership, you and most of the versions of the Creative Cloud membership basically entitle you to all of the Adobe Creative apps. But it's more than that. It's Space Online, it's Typekit, it's some of these new collaboration platforms. Maybe you can speak a little bit to the larger piece of Creative Cloud and how it's more than just the apps that users have been using.
Yeah, it's more than just the apps. And one thing people might be wondering, we just did an update, for example, to CS6 for Premiere, what we call in the 605 update, and we had just come out with a 604 update. And some of these updates we weren't allowed to do the way that we wanted to do, and this includes CC, because of Sarbanes-Oxley, different laws about how we can update. A very boring topic. It's probably a podcast.
We've actually talked about it on this podcast before.
Exactly.
And people might, just to relate it, people may remember that they used to have to pay for Apple iOS updates.
Exactly.
And Apple always said, Sarbanes-Oxley, because...
And you're right, because it was the iPod Touch, but not the iPhone.
Yeah, and it's because of basically the way that a company has to pre-account for future revenue generation.
It's almost like promises, right? You're promising me this feature. Did it actually happen or not happen? And who did you notify that these changes were?
And that your accounting principles might not allow you to, quote-unquote, give away something that hadn't, quote-unquote, been promised to the user.
Right.
And so having everyone under this blanket subscription model where you're just pre-accounting for a flat dollar amount per year from user allows you to kind of throw those concerns to the wind, right?
Right. And that's the first thing about Creative Cloud that is sort of breaking barriers, if you will, to be corny with visuals, if you can imagine. But there's a train that leaves Adobe every month. So every 30 days, that's, you know, of course we could do it every day if we wanted to, but the idea is maybe every 30 or so days, something out of the suite might get an update. And again, they're not really pushed. You're just notified, much like if you're an iPhone or Android user, you get a little notification that says, hey, there's an update. So you'll actually see that. So there's a train that leaves every month. And I mentioned the 605 update, for example, because we released 604, and fairly quickly there was an issue with 4 for just a small subset of users, and we quickly pushed out 5 within days later, or 605, I should say. So we're watching what's going on all the time. So that's the first benefit out of that. And then you mentioned the other parts of that. You know, we've got there's storage. There's what we call Business Catalyst, which allows you to have up to 5 websites that you can host. So if you're paying a service provider, for example, for a website, and you're trying to figure out, well, how can I cost justify all of my monthly fees? You know, that might be something you look at. So service provider fees you can put under Business Catalyst. It's pretty good. The other thing is something we had talked about earlier today, Behance. So that's a sort of a social site where you can sell yourself, you can sell your work, people can comment on your work.
Have you thought about introducing dating?
Hey, you know, it might happen. We might have our first wedding.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that would be great. There's a lot of us single
guys. That's
great.
You can put your portfolio of your 3D effects bumpers, and maybe in between there's a
single
proposal.
Little icon.
Just like always use your phone number.
Sure. Sure. I have to say the Behance is, I think that was a boon for Adobe.
Yeah.
I mean, they're already a very vibrant community, and to just sort of like tap into the vein of that. I know plenty of visual effects artists that were there just as a starting point. That's going to do much to sort of bring them into the fold, I think. I know we have clients that have Behance profiles. And you know.
It's a little like Facebook for those people that don't, but for the creative, and you can basically follow the people that you want to follow. You can go out and, you know, if you make this work public, you can say, hey, I want to throw this out here. I want to categorize it. And if you are a creative that buys content, or maybe you're another creative that is just needs like almost like a stock footage piece, if you will, you might see something you like and you can contact that person and say, hey, I'd like to buy the rights to do that. So it could be a moneymaker.
It is. And also just really excellent for anybody who's sort of trying to put their toe in that water, sort of see what people are doing out there.
And what people think, right?
Yeah.
Do I have as much talent as my mom says I have?
And no. If I don't, can somebody at Behance, you know, maybe connect me with the right folks that they'll help me learn some more, you know?
The other one that I think is really fascinating, it was like Behance, another acquisition that Adobe made, is Typekit. A lot of people don't realize full use of Typekit, and you can maybe speak a little bit to mm-hmm. what that allows Creative Cloud users, comes with your Creative Cloud subscription. This used to be their own company, their own service. It's basically gives you access to just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of fonts that you can then freely use across any Adobe app or even for web development purposes.
Yeah, and products like Microsoft Office, if it's on your machine, you can other apps can have access to those fonts.
I mean, for the, let's say it's roughly, I don't know, $600 a year per user for cloud. I mean, that like alone seems like
sure.
for a lot of users, it's worth
crazy.
It.
It really is. I mean, I used to work with an old school publishing guy in New York City that when we sat down to graphic design, he'd pull out literally $4,000 worth of fonts that he had on hard drives. And then it was time
to go. It's very hard to navigate those fonts,
yeah,
too.
And then it's time to go find that one DAX font that, you know, existed in a certain manner that was customized in 1992 or whatever, right? So here what we're seeing is a full suite of fonts that are fully functional, integratable, not just within the Adobe environment, but within word processing in general.
And that whole interface for the Typekit is also meant to sort of collaborate. I mean, when you look at it and you bring it up, you'll see an option for Typekit. You click browse. You can say, I'm looking for a heavy font or I'm looking for a cursive font. And you just sort of navigate, and it keeps helping you narrow those choices down. And once you click on it and said, yep, I either want a web font or a desktop font, you click on that, it updates your Creative Cloud on that machine. And let's say, this is another great benefit of Creative Cloud, you go home for the day or you go to a friend's house and you log on to their machine as yourself, it will go ahead and update the font so you have it available to you as your user ID. Remember, that's your new serial number.
So the fonts they travel
they
with.
They sync. Yeah, they sync. Do.
And so, you know, there's even some like fun stuff, right? I remember seeing, I can't remember, I think it was an Adobe announcement a few months ago where there's like an iOS app that allows you to take photos of things and it kind of creates a color profile that then syncs up to cloud.
Cooler.
Explain that, just because, again, it's kind of one of these funkier aspects.
It's amazing. I tell you, while we're on there, grab my bag over there, and I'll show it to you guys, and we'll get your voice reaction of what you...
To something that's inherently visual.
It's inherently visual. So what's cool about it is, let's say that you're looking at some flowers or you're on a nature hike, and you just pop out your iPhone, and because, you know, a lot of artists, you know, they just see things much like people saw things in the Matrix that maybe other people don't see, and they see colors and they things talk to them.
I see lots of things that people don't see all the time, man.
do you see dead people?
And then, well, you know, this may work for cadavers, I guess, but if you hold the phone over that, whatever it sees, it'll pick you know, five or six primaries that you can then use as a color set.
And well, I'll relate this to Baltimore. Amazing. We've got a lot of these funky painted row homes here, right? And so you could see one with like just this totally bizarro and yet somehow kind of functional combination of colors.
You know what I call that combination? I call that dereliction chic.
Yeah. That might be actually a good description for my row home in Baltimore.
Oh, yeah. or pretty much anybody's row home in Baltimore.
I did just get it repainted, by the way. No more pink door on greenhouse with white trim. It's just
okay, so
greenhouse with white trim and white door now.
So now it's slightly more difficult to find Nick at his home.
I can no longer describe it by pink door.
Oh, that's pretty cool. It's like, it's moving all over the place, too. That's pretty
impressive. Oh, there's a bunch of, like, bouncing little dots of changing colors moment to moment.
As you move the iPad.
It's pretty slick when you actually see it work. So just go download Cooler. That's with a K. K-U-L-E-R.
David, who knew you were inherently free. Just a great color palette?
Yeah, and then as soon as you do that, it'll sync that. You can give it a name. You can share palettes. And Cooler's been out for a while, but it hasn't been this cool to do that. And now another thing you might look at, you look at the Chesapeake logo, right? You've got that certain blue and that certain green and white. It would pick up all four of those colors on that sign, and you would have a cooler palette.
He's not lying, folks. It actually works.
Yeah.
That's wicked. And it's a lot of fun. And again, it's just like one of these neat things that having this quote-unquote cloud-based framework allows for that interacts with your creative apps in this very kind of fluid, natural way. So, I use it as an example, not because maybe it's like the selling point of Creative Cloud, but it's showing people what it gets you above and beyond just access to the latest apps.
Right. And it also goes into what you said at the beginning of the podcast, which is like, talk about technology and things that are changing and where's Adobe going? And that's a perfect example of how to take something cool and make it cooler. No, how to make something cool and make it useful. That's like, wow, this is a technology. How do we actually bring this into the cloud? Because just because we have these dots moving around and I can sort of freeze them in place and say, okay, give me a color setup, then what do you do with it? Well, you send that up to the cloud, and then you can start to see where all this starts to fit in.
Oh, I thought it was just the dots moving around changing colors, and that was
cool
enough for me.
A little impressed, Nick, these days. So we're getting not just an app like this, we're getting a full suite of iPhone and iPad apps as part of our Creative Cloud subscription.
You're getting, we'll talk about this, we've already mentioned Adobe Anywhere, but there's an Anywhere app, there's a Prelude logging app, if we're talking about video products, for example, that allow that to interact. You know, obviously there's Photoshop Touch. So the apps team at Adobe for apps for mobile is a very busy team, and I've seen lots of prototype stuff, and it's really exciting.
Adobe is a pretty big company. They're public, so you can say what your revenue is, right?
Yeah, a lot. And we've got about 10,000 employees or so.
That's pretty big.
Yeah, and it's
some big buildings that I've seen driving around.
Yeah, we have lots of headquarters. Whenever we buy companies or merge with companies, we typically have kept those headquarters. You know, the old Macromedia building still there, the Aldis building, which is where After Effects is now done,
and they're all connected undergrounds by tunnels with high speed maglev trains being operated by gray aliens.
I guess you would say it's Adobe Anywhere, huh?
Yeah. There you go.
So let's talk about the cloud announcement. And we're recording this today on, what is it, Monday, September 8th or something?
9th. It's the 9th, and IBC is upon us.
Yeah, IBC is about to start. This is the big European video trade show, kind of like the Euro version of NAB with legalized marijuana.
What I tell people is...
So it's the NAB.
It's everything that was promised at NAB, but now shipping.
Understood. And exactly. So there is this announcement for a new, somewhat major update to a lot of the video apps in Creative Cloud that has been announced in a press release today as of Monday.
Yeah.
People are going to be hearing this a few days later, so it'll probably be, even closer to being actually publicly available by the time people are listening to this podcast. But give us an example, because this was like the first big update to, I think, After Effects, Premiere, a few of the other big apps.
Yeah, and even Photoshop got Adobe Generator came out today, which is very cool for people that are making web graphics. And you can turn on the Adobe Generator option under the file menu, which will, as you're working through layers, start parsing things out for web work. It's really cool. You can check out a video online. And a lot of these features I'll tell you about today. What's awesome about the cloud, we have 150 new features in today's announcement alone out of all the video apps, which is a lot. This is our second big update. We only started shipping CC in June. So if you think about it, we already had a big update in the first week of July, about a month later, and here we are a little more than a month later, and we're on our second big update, and this is just really the video app. So
I mean, this would have been like a full .5 release back in the old days.
Right, and to me, they're very sensitive about saying, how do we break this up so people don't get overload from too much information? Well, whenever we release these types of features will release videos to go with them. So you'll be able to say, you know what, I would love a 3-minute video on this feature or that feature. And that's, you actually have some of those are live today.
I would say that the video content that the Adobe community is generating from Adobe Direct on how to do things is really top notch. I mean, with other programs, if I come into a little bit of a snag and I got to do a Google search, if it's not an Adobe product, I got to dig through YouTube. But when it comes to looking up how to do something very simply for a new Adobe product, Adobe TV is where it's at.
Yeah, is that the portal? Yeah, I just want to do this.
It's tv.adobe.com.
That's tough to remember.
Yeah, and if you type in Adobe TV, it'll reroute you anyway. And there's Dave Tech Table on YouTube, or you can just type in D Helmly, D-H-E-L-M-L-Y, and that'll get you to that. And we try to put different types of videos depending on where we think the audience might be. I typically will take whatever on Dave Tech Table, and that's digital audio video. It's not me being vain, but Dave Tech Table, and bring that over to Adobe TV. So you can find it in either place.
Do you turn off the YouTube comments for that? Because, man,
I don't.
Nothing makes me want to like press a red button and end humanity more than reading YouTube comments.
Yeah.
It is literally the lowest of the low.
Yeah, and most of those things, the comments go through, they have to go through the person that posts them. But I usually let them go. If someone's got something negative to say,
but usually it's like something just totally off the wall, not even related to the video, usually involving swears.
So we do read epithets. The comments first. But I'll tell you the most beautiful thing about these announcements and where the changes are coming from, and I would advise, you know, anybody that really wants to get involved with how the product's made, under the help menu in our apps is the product improvement menu item. That's really important because I get about 6 to 7 emails an hour just on Premiere alone that basically as a product request. Sometimes they think it's
a bug. People actually like read those requests?
Every single one for Premiere goes across my desk. So I should say through my
inbox.
I might
be sending you an email or so later.
Absolutely. You can put it right in there. And so when people, I'll give you a perfect example. We didn't have rippling time markers. Sounds pretty obvious, but it was a major rework, and we kept saying over and over again, how come when I ripple this, my markers don't move? Final Cut's been doing it for a while. Old Premiere did it. What's up with this new stuff? And it's like, okay, well, we'll go in and fix that. So we had a lot of requests for that. We now have support for the new Blackmagic Cinema D&G Raw. I mean, I would say every other one that I got for a long time was all about, when are you going to support, you know, this format that Adobe was heavily involved in called Cinema D&G? And it was an enormous amount of work to get that to work for really just a few cameras that use that codec. And now you have it fully. So when the users really get involved, they can really make the product better. And I will always tell people, don't be shy to put your phone number in there. It's only going to Adobe people. Don't put a nasty email address that isn't really your email address.
You're not going to get like a squad of Adobe ninjas showing up at your doorstep.
The guy that runs the Premiere engineers, his name is Dave as well. There's lots of Daves that are in video. There's too many of us.
There's two at this table right now. It's crazy.
So it's silly, but Dave McGavern's his name. And I don't know why he does this, but if someone emails and says, hey, I'm really looking for this or this isn't working, Dave will actually use his email and respond. I think he's nuts. I would probably use another email.
Hey, Steve Jobs used to do it once in a blue moon.
I know, but he does tons of them. I saw today 237 replies on Blackmagic, people that were complaining about the Blackmagic Cinema D&G camera. He must have kept all those in a folder and then put in, you know, the link to today's announcement that talks about that particular feature, and he sent it to them. So that would be a lot of people that are just like, wow, somebody's listening. Somebody cares. And we do, because, you know, we will rank those and list them on a top 100 list, and that helps us tell us what do we need to concentrate. Because now, remember, more than ever, if you have a monthly membership or a yearly membership, you now have opportunity to cancel and say, they're not doing what I need them to do. So, you know, our job is to keep you involved with the product so you want to buy it. You feel like you're a part of what's going on. And that's really part of the whole Creative Cloud
messaging. You want to mention a couple of snazzy whiz-bang features from today's announcement, just, you know, particular to video users?
Yeah, so I'll give you a couple. Some of the big ones, as I already said, you know, Blackmagic, great support for 6K format, so Red Dragon support. enhanced support for 4K workflows. Lots of, you know, Sony's got some new 4K cameras that they just announced. They're all there. You know, some of the Sony RAW formats are there. Canon 1DC uses a special photo JPEG codec. And we had that before, but now it's just better. Monitor overlays, hover scrubbing sequences is pretty cool. So if you want to have a whole lot of sequences and be able to go through those really, really quickly without opening them on the timeline. But the biggest one is getting more people involved with SpeedGrade. For me. So we now have a technology that we refer to as Direct Link. So if you're in Premiere and you have all sorts of videos stacked on top of each other, I've got some After Effects, dynamic links where After Effects and Premiere are talking back and forth. I've got some titles. I've got all these other things going on. When I Direct Link this over to SpeedGrade, you'll actually see that exact same timeline over in SpeedGrade.
This is big. It really is. This is big. I mean, I'm excited about this.
And you actually got to see it earlier today.
I did. So. I got to see it earlier today. And, you know, just for a little bit of context, if you had to do this in CS6, there were two methods. One, which is very processor intensive and is an industry standard as far as feature films are concerned. And that's, you know, a DPX workflow. The other one is EDL exports and then EDL, re-imports.
Yeah.
In my own personal experience, I hit a snag. I had errors in my EDL list. I had to, I had to go and edit them. I had to figure out what edit and what cut and what didn't line up. I ultimately was discouraged,
Because you wanted the opportunity to dig in and play with it.
I did. I wanted the opportunity to dig in and play. And the last go round, I didn't feel like the product was fully integrated. But after what I saw today, I'm very excited for that because it's going to bring a lot of folks into the fold. And I think certainly for our clients that are evaluating whether or not color correction in-house is a viable option. We believe it is, and this is really the next step, that you're going to be able to round-trip it with Direct Link and not really have to deal with an EDL headache.
Oh, yeah, and no export of file, no min or re-import.
There's no XML either.
Yeah, you go to file, you send Direct Link to SpeedGrade, boom, SpeedGrade pops up, there it is. You do your tweaking, you do your color correction or grading, and then you hit that little Premiere button.
That's it.
And then it kind of syncs it back to your Premiere project, and you're done.
So there's a new Premiere button inside of SpeedGrade. So when you're working and by the way, you could originate a project inside of SpeedGrade as well and hit the Premiere button and send it over. So it's pretty cool that way as well.
That one really does excite me. I think my initial impression when I first saw SpeedGrade was, oh my God, this is exciting. But then when I launched it,
it's very different. Yeah.
And I almost didn't seem like it, had the Adobe skin on it. It was just...
Well, I should also mention, when you're in that Premiere Direct Link mode that we're talking about, there's a lot of things in SpeedGrade that get shut off that wouldn't work in that workflow anyway. So with that mode, we tried to make it less confusing. There's no, stereo 3D options because you didn't, that's not the media that you're working with.
That's not your timeline, right?
Right. There's a bunch of other things that are just sort of turned off because users don't click on things that won't work for that workflow. So it's almost like a subset that actually allows me to get in and color grade. And don't forget, you've got full surface control devices and all that kind of stuff. So it's a true color grading workflow.
And Dave, remind our listeners how much SpeedGrade, as its own separate program before Adobe acquired the developer, used to cost.
Yeah, it was right around $42,000 was what people were
and now
paying.
It's just bundled into just your bundled Creative in. Cloud. So anyone who's complaining about the Creative Cloud pricing, just shut up.
And those engineers, by the way. The SpeedGrade engineers are still at Adobe writing it today. So we talked about companies earlier and what do we look at and what about buying this sort of vertical product or whatever. It's all about retaining the brains that, in this case, made SpeedGrade. And I have to give the SpeedGrade team credit. I mean, the Lumetri effects and the looks and LUT technology that's in Premiere today that this Direct Link is hinging off of is all from the Germany team that did SpeedGrade, so the old Iridos team. Mm-hmm. So that's really what we look at, and it's neat. And it's nice that you're finally getting that benefit because I don't even have to tell you, do an XML thing, and by the way, you can't do this, 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 and this. It's like SpeedGrade now reads Premiere Pro's sequences, and that Mercury engine is in there that allows that to work. And by the way, SpeedGrade now supports a lot of the file types that Premiere supported, not just the few that they did before.
Sure, and this is what I was waiting for all along. And I knew it was coming, and it's very exciting to hear that it's here today. because it's something that I've been waiting to play with for a very long time, and I think could be an amazing cost-effective solution for some of our clients. You know, just, you know, think about it. 15 years ago, renting out a color correction room in New York City.
Oh, yeah.
What the cost of that?
Less than 15 years ago, you know, really like 5 to 10 years
yeah,
ago.
Absolutely. Yeah, and there's a lot of money and work. And I know one feature you reacted pretty big to today, when we now export out of Premiere or the other apps through Adobe Media Encoder, we now gave you watermarking. What did you think of that?
Well, I thought watermarking was great. And I also saw the integration of the Lumetri overlays. So one of the things you can do at Final Export is put a watermark or overlay time code.
Or define a LUT that you want the encoder to go through.
Sure.
So and that's all user feedback. I mean, especially the watermarking, because you've just spent 8 hours. And
I mean, I can tell you at least 16 instances in my mind where I needed to do a batch export of multiple pieces of video that needed to be time coded, needed to be low res, and needed to be watermarked. And I could hit 2 out of 3 of them by just exporting this out from
Adobe Media Encoder.
AME,
Adobe.
Yes.
So, you know, that is very exciting. Certainly when it comes to everything from generating content for YouTube channels to burning in time code, I mean, it's really very flexible. And I think it's something that should have been there all along. So I think it's great. Setup.
Yeah, and that's to one for me. The watermarking took forever to come out. For our After Effects fans out there, I'll tell you that you've been asking for faster and better GPU support. So we've expanded that. So much like Premiere, where you can have really any graphics card, NVIDIA CUDA-based or AMD, say, OpenCL, or in some cases Intel OpenCL-based, some of the Iris graphics stuff, you can now have that working inside of After Effects. So if you have a gig of RAM or more, you have the ability to say, you know what, I want to go ahead and make this work, and you can turn cards on just through it, through a preference or a project setting.
So no more editing of preference files.
Right. Yeah. There's no reason to tweak anything or delete anything. It'll now just work. So Maxon now also works faster when you're doing some of the 3D pipeline stuff. And one of the big things, what I like to tell After Effects users, the moneymaker, is a mask tracker. So you can now set up a mask point and then say, you know what, I want to track this headlight or whatever this is so I can replace this, and we'll actually track that.
Now, I'm not a compositor or graphics guy, but that wasn't always in After Effects?
Not mask tracking. We could do other types of tracking. That's pretty cool. But when you were tracking things, you'd have to take the tracking data, create a mask, apply the data. It was a lot of steps. This is just automatic, and it's very,
a lot
very
of
fast.
Friendly keyframing.
This is the kind of stuff that people used to spend like hundreds of thousands of dollars on a flame or a smoke system to get. Now it's just built in.
It's just built in, and there's a video to go along with it. You can go up there and check it out. I think you'd watching that, any After Effects user watching that for 5 seconds, you'll get exactly what it's trying to do. So it's like a 2-minute video, and it's
Wicked. Fantastic.
Wicked.
So let's move on to another interesting new Adobe technology that's relevant to a lot of the video folks, or I think will become more relevant to the video folks over the next few years, especially people who have Premiere-based and soon-to-be After Effects-based workflows. And this is this thing that some people may have heard of called Adobe Anywhere.
Yeah.
And Anywhere is an interesting concept. The way I kind of have described it to people is, let's deprecate the importance of project files a little bit and emphasize a collaborative, working off of a server type of approach for workgroup users, potentially even remote users.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe you can describe a couple of the key things with Anywhere, because, you know, as you know, a lot of what we deal with at Chesapeake are, you know, complex workflows, workflow automation, media asset management systems, whether it's through our friends Levels Beyond, who have the Reach Engine, the Cantimo guys who do Portal and Cantimo Enterprise, CatDV from Squarebox, a few of the others that we're involved with. We deal with workflow stuff regularly, but Anywhere, you know, not a ton of those MAMs are really good at binding together the project side workflows. Some of them have more of those capabilities than others, but a lot of them are essentially clip library systems.
Right.
And yes, there's a lot of automation that can be, you know, possible by integrating them with other platforms, but very few of them have a ton of intelligence when it comes to parsing, say, a project from Premiere or After Effects and then enabling interesting collaborative workflows because of that. They're mostly oriented around media files.
Right.
Anywhere is kind of the MAM or DAM, digital asset manager, for your video projects, right?
Yeah, so what it tries to do is it says, okay, if we have a central machine, we'll just call that the server, and it's got all this horsepower in there, so maybe I'm working on a MacBook Air, is one way I demo it, for example. I can be wireless or I can be wired. Hopefully have a halfway decent connection.
Maybe even remote over like a VPN connection?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You could be remote out of a hotel or in your house. Talking to New York City or Amsterdam. When I'm demoing it, our servers are in Hamburg and San Jose. So when I'm ever showing anybody, that's where those two servers are. But the idea is if I have all this horsepower up in the cloud, and the important thing about Adobe Anywhere is it sort of looks like it's cloud-based, but it's your cloud.
It's a quote-unquote private cloud.
It's private cloud on premises. It's your server that's set up, and it's got some NVIDIA cards in there that are really fast, these K10 cards that are in there. So assuming you've got the computer, you've got your storage, you've already talked about some of your partners, Levels Beyond and some of those guys, you've got these things connected, and all that's working now. Anybody with a copy of Premiere, and I mean anybody, you might have just hired a freelancer, can come in on Mac or Windows. It doesn't make any difference. And, of course, all the cloud stuff we're talking about today is Mac or Windows, which you get full access to either platform under the same license. But you can say, okay, log into this. It can use LDAP as a way for credentials, or you can assign them a password. You can assign them to a project file. It's now a production, right? So we have inside Premiere, After Effects, or Prelude, you'll see start a production or start a project file. So project file is what you're used to seeing today. Production is a shared project.
And so there's no like Premiere project file living on your local storage that
remote.
You've created. It's really this thing that now exists in a database on the
Correct.
Anywhere server.
Correct. So let's look at the workflow. So you're in your hotel room. You've just shot a bicycle race that you're reporting on, something new, or maybe some gal that's swam from Miami to Cuba. You've landed. I now have to get this. And it's very good for news right now. We're starting to see a lot of people interested in news. So as you take your Canon 5D material, you stick it in there, you're editing natively. All this was working great. I've got my rough cut set up. As soon as I save that production, it starts to, because that's sort of the checkpoint that it's acceptable the way that it is. I save it, but you can still edit. It starts now to send the bits and pieces back to the server so they get in sync. And once all of the assets that you've loaded locally mm-hmm. get synced, it unlinks them, if you will, from the local machine, because it now says, okay, these are no longer part of a local production. They're a full-on production
on
the server.
Is it sending the full res or whatever native
full-res
format?
Full res, yep.
So obviously your upstream bandwidth as a remote user depend. You know, you
that's why it doesn't. That's why it doesn't sort of take you out of the workflow. It's smart enough to know when the file's complete and when it's not complete. So the user, what's beautiful about it is the user doesn't know any of that.
You don't get like a little status window
you
telling
can,
you?
If you want to open up that panel, you can open it up and sort of see what's going on. Absolutely, that's available
but
for
the
you.
But the idea is that
it's called a progress panel.
This is going to happen over time as you. So I put a string out together, right?
Yeah.
And I go, okay, that's about 70% there. You know, maybe I even punch in some scratch audio right there in the hotel room. And
then you're on the cell phone talking to your boss and you're chatting outside for 15 minutes or you met a pretty girl because you're in Starbucks editing and you're there talking to her for
15 minutes. That'll never happen.
For 50, well, we'll keep our...
So
you're having...
He's married. Well, yeah. Now, I, on the other hand...
All right.
Let's send some pretty girls over to him in Starbucks.
But you can see the point when you get interrupted or things are going on. The computer's like, okay, well, he's busy. I'm going to take full advantage of what's going on. And what's neat about it is there's never a hiccup in the workflow. If you're full on and you're editing, it's going to say, you know what? There's nothing I can do to help this guy out other than give all I can do locally. Mm-hmm. As soon as he starts to let up, it's just sort of this throttle that just, and again, it's beautiful because you don't have to worry about it. Let's face it, news editors, people that do this for a living, not really that exciting. They're just going to edit. Maybe they're a 9-to-5-er. They just want to get it done and get it done quick and not worry about all this minutia in the background. They just want to edit and get it done.
Now, let's take it from the other side. Let's say you're a remote user. Let's say you're a freelance editor. You've got a relationship with a production company. You know, maybe you've moved, but they still want you to be involved with editing this reality show. They like you. Yep. They like your style. You're efficient. Let's say they've begun an Anywhere production on their Anywhere server. And now they're like, okay, we got a bunch of this raw footage logged in. It's in this production that we created. Log into the production. We gave you login rights.
Yep.
And edit this. Make an episode of TV.
Or, to your point, he may be the best After Effects guy for this particular piece that we need fixed. There's a button on the dashboard of this car that I need to replace with something else. It's a lot of tracking. This, nobody knows, say, After Effects scripting for this sort of thing like this one guy that is in this remote site. So
that's been started by someone else. Maybe it's mm-hmm. even a local user at that production facility, yep. that post company, whatever it is. And I'm now a remote user. I fire up After Effects. I open a production that I have access to. I either have maybe VPN connection into the home base, and so I can hit their Anywhere server. I now wait basically for media to be cached to me, and I download media and wait, and it takes until it's available. And once it's downloaded on my machine, I can start.
No, you could pretty much start working immediately.
So how does that work? Tell our listeners how the magic of technology makes
that work.
Yeah,
let's take Premiere for example. So on Premiere, it's just streaming what you see in the program window, and we can make the quality pretty if the bandwidth allows us to make it pretty. So the slower the bandwidth, it sort of degrades in quality.
Is the rough bit rate range per stream of video that an Anywhere user is typically
I think we're targeting hotel bandwidth rates or home bandwidth rates.
It's like a megabit per stream.
Yeah, it could be. It could be a little higher than that. I think our goal, I mean, I've seen people do it over LTE. Not really something I would advise, but you're going to use whatever you're going to use. So the better your connection, the better the experience. For version one, we actually advised people to really understand how Anywhere works. Just run it on your local network. I mean, hardwired. Yeah, you can do it on wireless. That'll work. But to really understand how the system works, what we don't want to see is someone thrown out in Brazil somewhere who has to do an edit, and there's too many things they may or may not know where a problem may end up being. Would it work? Yes, it'll work. I've actually been in Brazil working on a server in Hamburg, and it worked.
So
it worked fine.
So the Anywhere server, because it has that NVIDIA card, now it's not even taking proxy versions of the video that it had to generate ahead of time and streaming them to you as the remote Anywhere user. It's generating those streams in real time. Based on you hitting play either on a clip or on your sequence, right?
Right. So as soon as you hit play, it already knows the bandwidth because it's doing lots of analysis. It'll play the video back, and as soon as it stops playing, it'll deliver a full res frame.
So the bandwidth allocation is kind of dynamic because it's dynamic. Talking to your local instance of Premiere or After Effects and doing little tests in the background.
Right. So what I was showing in this Brazil example was we were editing red 4K, and it was a green screen, and I'm putting a green screen effect. So, and I'm on a MacBook Air. So imagine I'm doing 4K on a MacBook Air, doing a green screen effect, and it was working all in real time.
So the interesting thing about this is, let's look forward a little bit. And by the end of the decade, a lot of people, I think, will have gigabit plus connectivity to the internet, if not office-wide, maybe even on a per-user basis, right? It's already here in a lot of countries, and it's starting to get rolled out in the U.S. And we know that, even in really more the next 3 to 4 years, the LTE advanced cellular data networks are going to roll out. These are going to be hundreds of megabits per second, probably, on your mobile device. you know, just cellular data.
And cell phones are already shooting 4K now anyway. So,
you know, what's interesting about this is, I mean, do you feel that the quality of these streamed version of the projects are enough for at least a good number of users to do finished work?
When we show anywhere to a lot of customers, they're astounded that what they're looking at isn't full quality. That's a streamed quality because it's pretty clean. The algorithms, you see what Photoshop can do for making pictures bigger or smaller. Mm-hmm. I mean, the streaming algorithms that are in there are pretty amazing. They're not sort of chunky, low res, blocky. I can't really figure out. I mean, it is a beautiful, pristine. And if you're familiar with how we can lower the quality from half to 16 or 8. It's even better than that. It's much, much cleaner than what you would see.
Now, let's throw this out there. Let's say you have certain users in your office who are on a fiber channel SAN. It's either XSAN, preferably StorNext. They've made that switch.
Yep.
And some of their workstations are direct connected. Other systems that people use are simply Ethernet connected to the general network and touching that anywhere server. Is there a way for anywhere to make sure that users who are fiber connected are actually seeing the full res
files? It's per connection.
So
yes.
You basically can say if you're this user at this MAC address or whatever, make sure that they're actually playing back the full res media files off of the SAN.
You don't have to do that. We do that automatically. We give best experience per client.
So if they have access to the full res video files on the SAN, it won't even attempt to send them the stream. It'll let them just play back the full res files?
Well, I think that's part of the magic. They're not going to be able to tell the difference. What it's actually doing, that's just part of its magic. I'd have to be honest with you. I think it still would be giving you a streamed.
It's just probably so high.
It's almost like it's almost like a full res stream, if you will, but it's just a way that anywhere works.
Well, one of the nice things I see about this is in a lot of our environments, I don't see it negating the need to have a SAN. People still need very large, big blocks of storage that multiple systems can hit, you know, at very high speeds.
That's because we don't want to be in the storage business or, like we were saying, the asset management or the dam management business.
But one of the nice things about it is that it might severely diminish the number of individual client workstation systems that have to be on a SAN. And the SAN can be emphasized more for touching those back-end systems that really do need direct access to the full res file. And your clients, your editors, your creatives might not really need to be full-fledged SAN clients anymore if the experience is getting there, you know?
Yeah, true.
It's neat.
And there's a lot of things people have to realize because we are having people that are seeing the demos, and we actually go around on laptops and demo, you know, a little laptop server doing its thing, and we've got some Macs and PCs attaching to the server just to kind of show the principle of how it works. Well, they get very excited and they get these things installed and they want to have editors from all around the globe working on one project. Sounds right? But what they have to remember is, yes, it'll work and it works, but you can introduce latency due to the distances and the properties of the earth, right? So that it's what phone companies have to deal with all the time, just with voice latency. So now that people are this sort of one world editing group, and I got a guy in Russia's here, this guy in Brazil, this guy over here. So it's kind of like, okay, well, we want people to understand that there are distance and repeater issues and things like that, where just don't expect in some cases for extreme long distances that it's a problem with your server. Could be a problem with your service provider.
Well, I mean, like,
and some things you can't overcome because
I have a 50 megabit Comcast connection, but sometimes YouTube videos don't play that well, and that doesn't have to do with raw bandwidth. That has to do with how much traffic may be, you know, happening in a particular
traffic node. Stuff alone too, but just latency due to the curvature of the earth. I mean, there's all sorts of things.
But one thing, and that's kind of why I brought up the evolution of these networking technologies, one can kind of count on all of those things improving over the next few years. And so you've created this infrastructure now that as networking technologies, whether they're hardwired or wireless, just keep getting better and better, which they inevitably will, the anywhere service presumably will keep getting better and better. And the things that maybe you'll be able to do with it might grow and get more interesting over time.
And that's a good point, because the way anywhere for After Effects, we're calling it, it's an early look, or what we call early access. So anybody with an Anywhere service says, oh, After Effects is now supported. So we're working with those users now. We talked about syncing files. After Effects files will actually be synced by users. So if we're all working on the same thing, it will sync the assets the way that they need to be synced on all the machines. Because sometimes the After Effects files that you see, do you really want those stream the way that they are? So for early access, it'll be a syncing. But we do think, once we see and learn about the workflows, the way that After Effects users will use this, because remember, they'll be sort of in conjunction with maybe a Premiere project or a group of After Effects editors on one After Effects project with multiple comps, that our goal is to get that to be streamed exactly the same way you see it in Premiere.
So. Fascinating.
I just wanted to round this conversation about Adobe Anywhere, which I think is actually very exciting. It's very seldom that somebody comes into our office and really just lays out a whole bunch of really cool stuff, and I'm totally excited and on board. As our listeners know, we don't, we're not just shills. We really have very concerted effort and thought into the solutions we present. So talk a little bit about the other side of the production post-production process when it comes to Adobe Anywhere. So once these productions are saved and they make their way to the server, and now it's time to get the final edit out to the network.
So the process, and you're hitting it on the head. One thing that's disabled in Premiere, Prelude, and After Effects is the save button. There is no save button. It's weird, right? It's like I was telling you earlier, there's no export button, and we'll get to that in a second. But because the projects or productions, remember, new word for work groups, the production is in a constant state of save. And by the way, you also have revision. So you can go in and say, oh, well, let me walk back in time, which is really cool. It'll kind of watch your timeline on Premiere, for example, go back as you were walking hour by hour. Great way to show your boss what you've been doing over the past hour.
You sort of or a great way to give yourself this. A heart attack.
He may want to know where that 60-minute window went. But anyway, so...
How do you sneak in the two-hour coffee break?
It's getting harder, certainly not during
the render times. So
but if you look at this, the other thing that's pretty cool with what you're saying here is we also have an iPad app. So someone who is sitting at Starbucks, waiting for their lady friend or whatever, they can actually look at what's going on with the production. So they can log into the Adobe Anywhere iPad app, which will be up on the App Store soon, and they can scrub over sequences and look at it. It's really, really cool. So we're involving them in the project as well. Again, because there's no save, it's in a constant state of save. You might have just made a change to the sequence. When he logs in, he is seeing that change in that sequence right at that same time, within milliseconds of where you see it. So when you're done with, say, the production and it comes time to export, export is actually grayed out from an end user standpoint. Why? Because it belongs to the production. The production is in the back room, again, on the server. So there'll be a set of routines that you'll be able to maybe initiate from a panel. This could be something that a company like Chesapeake could write a panel, or there'll be some sample panels that come with it. A lot of times the exporting is also might be a part of the MAM system. So they want to use their set of exports because it might be put on a rundown or some other playlist that it needs to go out of. So there's full control of the production by the IT people, if you will, or the people that control the production from the output, because the output is where it always goes wrong. If it's not done right, it won't air right, the waveforms won't look right, and so forth. So there's full control over what happens to
the export. So you could, I'm just going to come up with an example workflow. I'm an end user. I finished an Anywhere production in Premiere. It's time for this to get rendered out, cataloged into our MAM/DAM/workflow automation system, which then triggers the publishing of a MOS object link into a playout system at a news channel that kind of gives a link back to this now final rendered project. I could have a panel, which is basically moving towards HTML5, and it's a custom window basically in this Premiere production. It has like a big button that says, submit. I hit that. That then kind of triggers a command to the Anywhere server, which I guess notifies an admin that it's ready to take a look at and
yeah,
send
and it's whatever processes you set up. And by the way, it worked the same for After Effects compositions too.
Could you force kind of an admin review of the project at that point?
Yeah, I think at that point you set up the pipeline for whatever it needs to do. Because I think a lot of people look at this, like we had talked about products like Final Cut Server and things like that, where a lot of people want this. And maybe at some point it gets easier and there's ways to do a lot of this. But for right now, there's a very set of processes and goals that need to happen before something can go on there. There could be rights management checkoff. There could be, as you said, cataloging for long-term storage and DLT tape or whatever it is. There's this process that happens once this thing is submitted and exported.
Yep. And again, that can involve you as the local user talking to the Anywhere server, which then in turn is talking to your MAM or DAM server, which could be talking to transcoding servers, which could be talking to, again, in the example I used, a MOS gateway server for ENPS for iNews or whatever. And it's just this very interesting dynamic of servers kind of talking to one another via APIs.
Yes.
And all of that was essentially triggered by a push button action from an end user in a little panel window in their Premiere.
And I think you can make it as easy or as hard as you want. Sometimes they don't want the end user doing anything on export. They may just say, my production's done. They radio someone or send them a note. Someone takes it from there. Or like you said, make a custom panel where you can drag a sequence in there and maybe you get five choices and a pull down that says, this is how I need this. Or it's just automated. You just stick it over there and it takes. The thing is, we're giving the control to the production owner.
Well, and what I love about it is, and it's a constant message we decry to our clientele and friends and whatever, that thinking about your workflows in depth and even whiteboarding them out, having a nice little pipeline graphic that explains your various workflows, this really can be an enabling technology for that. And if you really think about what feeds into what are your inputs, what are the processes, what are the outputs, what systems are feeding what, how are you delivering, how are you ingesting, Anywhere it makes a very nice and useful piece of that overall process. And now you can look towards automating certain aspects of that and take some of these more mundane tasks away from people and the things that they may need to do in a day that aren't terribly exciting and computers are good at automating.
Sure.
And let them focus on the human tasks, the creative tasks, the stuff that computers aren't so good at and people really need to do.
Yeah, agree. No, and that's exactly what it's trying to do. Again, put the control of the production back to the people that are most responsible for it.
So one last thing we want to pick your brain about a little bit while you're here is you guys have a very tight relationship with Apple.
Mm-hmm.
As a lot of our listeners know, we ourselves have a long-term and tight relationship with those guys. They've obviously gone through some interesting shifts over the last few years as far as how they seem to be relating to the pro video market and the pro space. We obviously know that Final Cut did some interesting transformations.
Yep.
Some might say the way that transition was handled was maybe not the most elegant from a,
Yeah, it was a bit of a shock for all of us.
Thankfully, it looks like they're learning and the recent introduction of their Logic Audio package seemed a lot more compatible with, making people happy instead of PO.
Yeah, and Apple's also a lot bigger company now. I think we all would agree with that.
So one big shift we've seen is the Mac Pro for probably about 2 years, people were saying, what's going on with the Mac Pro? As a lot of users know, the big silver boxes and essentially all of their innards are about 3.5 years old now.
Yeah.
There was a very, very minor, so minor an update about a year ago.
It's like a footnote.
That it wasn't an update.
Right, because
right?
It's not using any newer
there was no new
Intel
hardware.
Chipsets.
It was like the one of the chips got a slight bump to the
side. And no USB 3 would show you that it was an old Intel chipset.
Well, and it was the old Sandy Bridge E-chips. It was the old chipset. Really nothing new. So really we've had the existing big silver box Mac Pros for about 3.5 years. People are like, is Apple just going to get rid of them? Are they going to come out with something new? Interestingly, what Chesapeake told them to expect about a year and a half was what seems to have been now announced. We didn't think it was going to come in this little 8-inch cylinder. We thought it might be a square, but probably about the same size.
Right.
But we have this new thing they're calling the Mac Pro. It's this 8-9-inch tall cylinder. I often compare it to one of those mini kegs that Heineken has, but actually not even probably that big, a little smaller than
that. Yeah, it's pretty tiny. We actually worked with Apple before the Worldwide Developers Conference. Apple, and like you said, we have a very good relationship with Apple, especially the video team, certainly the Photoshop team, very tight relationship with Apple. And we've had employees that went to school together. Some of them are married. You know, it's just this sort of crazy world of that you live in when you live in the Silicon Valley area, if you will. So there, you know, there's just a lot of people working on a lot of cool stuff. And one of the things that was pretty cool was we got involved with Apple on this new Mac. I'll say maybe 6 weeks ahead of when anybody else knew about it, maybe 8 weeks. Of course, when we get these prototype boxes in, they don't look like what the final product looks like. So there's no way to say, hey, I know what's coming. All you know is Apple's got some new thing that's coming.
What did it look like?
Typically, I actually didn't see this one, but I've seen many other prototypes that they've sent us in the past. They just come in locked down black square chassis or silver chassis. And you can't.
So you don't even know what's inside.
You don't know. You know, and you try to sort of figure out, can you go to an Apple and
hold it up to your ear and shake it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So really all we're doing is just running sort of compatibility test. And we knew that it had a single processor, and we knew it had dual AMDs for OpenCL, and Apple's really gone down this OpenCL path, of course. And they wanted us to continue what we've done with Premiere, because even Apple has been extremely impressed at the 64-bit engine that we've done based on AV Foundation for the Mac. And they basically said, we would love to showcase Premiere Pro for the other developers out there, how they can harness the power of dual GPU. And that's really what this new cylinder Mac is all about. I mean, I think there's pros and cons to all these computers as they come out, but it's pretty exciting that you'll have this relatively small box. A lot of us might remember the Cube.
Now we have the Tube.
Now we have the Tube, exactly. So you'll start to see some similarities and excitement around that. So Premiere takes full advantage of those dual processors. We showed that running and, you know, Retina displays and all that sort of stuff. And having a lot of Thunderbolt ports is going to be pretty exciting as well.
And this is the sort of thing that sort of just bring it back to Creative Cloud here. When this hits the market, you're going to have full compatibility with this workstation?
Yeah. You know, and, you know, After Effects will be able to see those GPUs. Of course, Premiere already sees them today and some of the testing that we're doing. So, absolutely.
Do you know offhand how the apps are generally utilizing two graphics processors versus one? Is one basically used to draw stuff to screen and the other is then completely reserved
for
the math?
That's a good question. So there's different technologies. There's OpenCL, there's OpenGL that we all know, and of course in some cases there's CUDA, which is NVIDIA's technology, which is very good, and we've used that a lot in the past. So a lot of the UI can be drawn by either OpenGL or OpenCL, depending on what's going on. But when we go to export, one of the new features under Adobe Media Encoder is it takes full advantage of GPU and dual GPU. So if Premiere's got a GPU doing one thing, you've got another GPU that can be doing something else, which is kind of cool. So you can sort of split these tasks up. But a lot of people say, you know, I've got all this horsepower in there. I just want to just go full on and be able to do that. We also support debayering. Those Cinema DNG files, now we have a new debayering engine that's in there, sort of the Mercury debayer, I think is what engineering's referring to, and that uses GPU. So GPU is going to be extremely important, and I have a pretty good feeling that this new Tube unit, you know, this Mac Pro, or to me it's more of a Mac Mini Pro, and that's testament to how far the Mac Mini's actually come. It's actually more of a compliment than a negative. I mean, it is just a small form factor, lots of ways to expand externally on this machine. But it's going to be pretty exciting to see what people are able to do with that. And I think Apple's whole reason for being with that machine, if you will, is going to be all about GPU. So my guess for, say, Final Cut X in the future would be more GPU, more GPU, more GPU. That's what they're relying on.
Now, this Tube, this new Mac Pro, which weirdly I saw an ad for at a movie last night.
Yeah, I saw the same ad.
I guess maybe they're assuming that like Hollywood or movie or video people watch movies and they're trying to like
they
get
like to go
excited.
See their own work, I guess.
So it's obviously not really expandable internally. When you buy
it requires lots of AC outlets because everything needs a plug that you plug into.
Because it's all external now. Your little fiber channel adapter, your AJA IOXT, your Blackmagic Thunderbolt device, separate Thunderbolt chassis.
Anything with Thunderbolt needs power.
You think the market's going to take to this?
I think some markets, and I think the three of us were sort of sitting here chatting a little bit and thinking, well, for a lot of editors, it's probably going to work fine. You'll connect, I've always been a fan of USB 3. You'll plug that in or you'll plug a Thunderbolt drive in. And again, you get better performance if you actually plug it into the wall. You get a lot better performance, as some of us know. I think it's going to be fine. For those that are using an iMac that want to select their own 10-bit display or a 4K display, it's kind of like a headless iMac. I mean, let's just face it, with lots of Thunderbolt ports and dual GPU, that's all it is. There isn't anything really more to it than that. It's got a better processor. It's got an up-to-date processor, a newer Xeon-style processor. And we'll start to guess more about cores and things once Apple finally, decides what all the pieces are that'll be in that thing. But I think at the end of the day, when you're talking about someone who might have had a Mac Pro for the last 5 years or even 2 years, I refer to those machines as your trusted friend because you could upgrade that thing all the time. You could pop in SSDs, you could put in a new NVIDIA or ATI card, and you could limp that investment that maybe they got it at Chesapeake and they want to come back to Chesapeake and say, look, I love this machine, I want to keep it going. You're like, hey, for another couple $100, we can keep this thing going for another year. And then you want to know that if I put in a graphics card, I can pull that out and put that in maybe my new Mac that I might get. And a lot of people were waiting for that. So the problem is, we're not at that point. It's like a complete reboot of the way that we think. And I think that the best way to look at it is picture on your desk to find out if it's best for you. Put an object on your desk and just say, okay, try to figure out, use boxes or whatever. You're gonna take up a lot of space on your desk from all the things that you had inside that one machine. And you only had one power cord. Now you're going to have, and I've already done this on my desk. I've got some other machines that, laptops that I'm using to emulate Thunderbolt. So anyway, I would just tell you that there's going to be a lot of people where it's not going to work. And the biggest thing I've seen is being the tube instead of the cube is it's very hard to rack mount. So someone's going to have to invent.
It's going to go from, there are these rack mount kits for the Mac
Pro. It's going to be a wine rack,
just going to put them on little shelves, right? You're going to just use rack shelves and put a bunch of them next to one another.
Yeah, and we work with companies that have Macs in racks. Bruno Mars concert, I was just there the other day. A friend of mine, Jason, works, and Premiere, by the way, is running the timeline that does the graphic. That's pretty cool, and did the Madonna concert before that and Lady Gaga last year. So a lot of these guys are using Premiere, and I go back in. It's great because I get to go to the concerts, but I go back there and I get to check out what's going on, and I see them in these racks. And I'm talking to my buddy over there, and I'm like, what are you thinking? And he's like, well, I drew this thing up. What are you thinking? Daggone it, if it wasn't a wine rack.
Yeah,
it had
exactly.
This thing tilted, and it had six of these Macs on there, and that tells me, well, come hell or high water, he's going to run Mac. So while a lot of people might say, PC might be the best way, I'm a big fan. A lot of people know the HP Z A20s and their new ZBook line and some of these other things. Some people are going to be like, I'm going to try to make this work.
And we are big fans of the Z820 line as well. Mm-hmm. Chesapeake saw the writing on the wall many years ago that, our core competency can't just be Apple. So we also really do enjoy those.
Well, it's nice that they can come to you guys and sort of figure out what's best for them. But this new Mac is to sort of end on this note, is it's exciting in many, many ways. I think Adobe and the Pro Video team, I know the Photoshop team's got one. We're very excited to be involved with Apple on some of this thing. So
I was thinking of getting rid of my laptop, getting like a little hipster satchel for a Mac Pro, make it tube-shaped.
There
one
you
of
go.
These little Pico projectors.
Why don't you just put
you?
It it's on your happen. Back? You could be like a Buck Rogers guy.
Why don't we
go,
just take
go,
some
don't catch your hair on fire.
Get like a little mini projector. Just shine it on the wall if I go to meetings or whatever.
Yeah. The old one was a scoliosis maker. I mean, like, you couldn't, easily take a Mac Pro. So, I mean, that's something I'm excited
Although
about.
Although you felt like you were getting a lot for your buck because that thing was damn heavy.
Well, I guess so. I felt like I was paying my doctor a lot to fix my back.
I'm looking forward to like little R2-D2 outfits that people make for the
put
new
some
ones,
mustaches
little
on.
Samurai outfit,
yeah,
you could just sort
so
of see
cute,
that.
Well, Dave, we want to thank you so much for coming out here today. We've been wanting to get you on here for a long time, so we appreciate you trekking up.
Yeah, we'll try not to make it so long next time.
Yes, it was a pleasure. I've heard so much about you, Dave, and it was good to finally meet you proper. And you're going to be getting an email from me about some Premiere stuff, I think.
Yeah, please do.
We'll remind our users, please use those feedback panels in the Adobe software. Yeah,
it's under the help menu.
There are actual humans responding to that stuff. And obviously, if there's any questions you have about Adobe stuff, whether it's Creative Cloud or whatnot, us guys at Chesapeake, Merrill and myself, can certainly help you out as well. But thanks so much again for coming, and we look forward to see just all of the updates that are going to keep coming with Adobe, because there's really no reason not to just keep updating everything at this point. You guys are obviously really just pushing the boundaries and trying to keep things fresh and exciting.
Very excited.
Never out of date.
Cool. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, guys.